I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Silver Donald Cameron joins me now. He has just traveled across Canada to screen his new documentary and publicize the accompanying book. The book is called Warrior Lawyers, From Manila to Manhattan, Attorneys for the Earth. It's a book that accompanies the film, which both of which feature interviews conducted with trailblazing lawyers across the world who are leading the way, taking on national governments and global corporations when it comes to guaranteeing the human right to a healthy environment. The book and film ask the fundamental question, why then not in Canada and the United States? Don Cameron is a prolific author whose work includes nonfiction, plays, films, radio, novels, and journalism. He was the first dean of the School of Community Studies at what was then the University College of Cape Breton. He has taught at Dalhousie, the University of New Brunswick, the Banff Centre, and UBC, where he earned an undergraduate degree. Other degrees were had from the University of California and the University of London, England. He's received honorary doctorates as well, and is a member of the Order of Nova Scotia and a member of the Order of Canada. Visit silverdonaldcameron.ca for more. The book and the film can be had at thegreeninterview.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in person today, Don Cameron. Dr. Cameron, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Nice to be here.
Nice to meet you. This is your 18th book, is that right?
It is.
I just realized I didn't mention the name of the film in the introduction. What is that called?
It's called Green Rights, The Human Right to a Healthy World.
And, you know, when we think about it, we think that those are fundamental. But, you know, in a globalized world, you know, you can see how those rights can be trampled upon and ignored and possibly challenged. When we're talking about green rights, you're referring to the right to breathe clean air, access to clean water, and wholesome food. Well, why is it so hard for us to get those things in so many parts of the world?
Well, actually, the funny thing is that it's not in so many parts of the world. These are rights that are guaranteed in more than 180 nations, one way or another, either by treaties that the nations have engaged in, or over 100 don't have them in their constitutions. But among the dozen or so that don't are Canada and the United States, and that really is the impetus for this entire project, because I interviewed a wonderful guy named David Boyd, who you may know from Pender Island here in B.C., mm-hmm. And David had written a book called The Environmental Rights Revolution about the spread of environmental rights after the Stockholm Conference of 1972 all around the world, but not here. And when I found out, number one, that we didn't have these rights, and number two, that there were sensational impacts from or uses being made of these rights by people in other parts of the world, I thought, and my colleague Chris Beckett, who's the videographer in this partnership, mm-hmm. Chris and I thought, boy, this is it. If there ever was a story we need to tell to Canadians, this is it. You should know what they're doing in India. You should know what they're doing in Ecuador. You should know what they're doing in Greece and so on. And you should insist on having these rights yourself.
So take us back to the 1980s when Mr. Trudeau conceived of the Charter, not only Trudeau and others. Why weren't environmental rights included in that?
I don't know the answer to that, Joe, and it's a fascinating question because they were proposed. There was some real discussion of having those rights incorporated in the Charter in the first place,
yeah.
And I don't know what derailed that. One of my little fantasies, however, is that that Trudeau the Second will mm-hmm. complete the work of Trudeau the First and put them where they should have been in the first place.
And you and your wife Marjorie have crossed the country promoting your various projects, and one of the stops you made with your film is in Ottawa, and you talk to a lot of people there. Do you have a sense of where that might go from here?
Well, you know, it's interesting because David Suzuki has been raising the issue of environmental rights through his Blue Dot Tour and Blue Dot Movement, and has really made an impact. I think something like 145 or 150 Canadian municipalities have now passed aspirational declarations that their citizens have or should have these rights. And there are a couple of provinces that have versions of this. And just the week before I got to Ottawa, David Boyd had been there with the Suzuki Foundation pushing for this. So it's getting on the agenda. An MP named Linda Duncan in Edmonton brought forth a bill calling for these in the last parliament. It died on the order paper.
Yeah.
So I have a sense that, yeah, people are beginning to understand that this is important and that we don't have them, that we could have them. I know the issue has been brought to Catherine McKenna, the Minister of Environment, because an MP from Nova Scotia, Joe Casey, did that and invited her to come and see the opening of the film in Ottawa. And the Speaker of the Senate was kind enough to host us at a reception celebrating the completion of the film and the book. So, yeah, it's kind of on the agenda, and yeah. I have some hopes that it may that we may see it. And as I say, it would be a lovely sort of a closing of the circle if Trudeau the Second completed the work of Trudeau the First.
And in your travels across the country, you talk to people who are like-minded and who have bought the book, who've watched the film. You are hopeful that the people in this country recognize the importance of the environment, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's interesting is that we're in a sort of a state of kind of fantasy with respect to the environment in this country. I mean, most Canadians are astonished to learn that they don't have these rights. They just assume that they did. They think of us as very fine environmental stewards. In fact, our record ranges, depending a bit on the topic, from mediocre to abysmal. We're not really very good at this. We have our moments, but there are things about our environmental record that very few Canadians are aware of. For example, in South America, the most common villain in an environmental horror story is a Canadian mining company. There are a lot of mining companies based in this country. We have more mining companies, I think, than anyone in the world. And their record environmentally and in terms of human rights elsewhere is atrocious. Mm. So, you know, in a certain sense, there's a kind of a call to get real here. You know, we assume that we've got lots of fresh water. In fact, we don't have a huge amount of fresh water. Most of what we have is fossil water, like the water at the bottom of the Great Lakes has been there since the glaciers melted. Well, you can't draw that out. You can only draw the surface water that flows in and out of it. And that's the kind of thing where I think we live in a bit of a fantasy world.
Yeah, and so do you think young people are hip to that and know that the situation is dire as it is and that there is a sense of urgency?
They do, I think, have a sense of urgency, but I'm afraid that it shows up in ways that I'm sad about. I mean, I have had any number of young people say to me, well, what can one person do? In fact, I have a TEDx talk that I did based on that, just to show from some of the green interviews we'd done what one person can do. But I had a conversation in a restaurant in Nova Scotia not too long ago where I was talking to someone and they raised basically this very question. And the waiter was at the table at the time and he was a young guy, maybe 20 or 22 or something like that. And I said, well, I said, excuse me, do you intend to have children? And he said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, because I don't think I want to be responsible for bringing children into the world that we've allowed to get into such a state, kind of thing. And now that wasn't set up, but I've talked to enough young people that I felt reasonably confident that I could just ask this guy and I would probably get that answer. And that's an answer that makes me terribly sad. And in a sense,
it's frightening, you know?
Well, it is, and it's frightening because it's so he just so accepts that the situation is dire and that not much will be done about it.
Mm.
And so part of the effort that we've been making, Chris Beckett and I, is to say to young people, look, you don't know what's going to happen unless you try. I am somebody who thought there would never be a bridge to Prince Edward Island. I thought there would not be a black man in the White House in my lifetime. Look how wrong I was. You may be equally wrong. Get out there and do something.
Yeah. My parents are Filipino, so one person that you talked to who I thought was just fascinating is a guy from the Philippines, Tony Oposa. Did I pronounce that right?
Yep.
And so, what sort of work is he doing in terms of, because that's a country, the Philippines, where enshrined in its constitution are these green rights.
You can get in the Philippines a writ of kalikistan, which means nature, and you can get that to right an environmental wrong which stretches over two jurisdictions. So if you, Vancouver and Burnaby, were complicit in one environmental wrong, you could get rid of that kind of, it's a very
and I can and one can apply directly to the Supreme Court to stop whatever's happening, right?
Yeah. You can, yes. Well, Tony is a fascinating guy. If I were writing a book about a single warrior lawyer, it would probably be Tony. And his career, kind of his major career, began with going for a walk in the woods. And the Philippines have had this magnificent old-growth forest, but which has been pillaged now for well over a century. Goes for a walk in the woods, and the woods aren't there. They've been clear-cut. And he starts to look into this and realizes that something just over 90% of the original forest is gone, and that permits have been issued to take every single piece of the rest of it. And Tony thinks, well, we're leaving nothing for our children. So he goes and sues the Secretary of the Environment, whose name was Fulgencio Factoran, and says, you've got to stop issuing these licenses. And he's suing in the name of his own children, but also in the name of children yet unborn.
Mm.
And Several fascinating things happened. The first court, the lower court, threw it out on the grounds that you can't sue on behalf of people who don't yet exist. They have no legal standing in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. But eventually he won it in the Supreme Court. And one of the things that was fascinating was that Factoran was a great ally of his. Factoran wanted to do the right thing, but was under great pressure from the elected government and from corporations. And as Tony says, this put wind under his wings, and so he was able to go forward with that. Well, that duty to future generations on the part of the present generation is now known as intergenerational equity, and it's a principle known as the Oppoza principle, mm-hmm. properly, and is now invoked all over the world. So yeah. What can one guy do, right? And that's just the start. Then he did another whole thing in Manila Bay. He did a 9-year suit there, making the government stop dumping raw sewage into what had been an incredible ecological jewel. He did some work in the Visayan Sea, where people had been fishing with dynamite and cyanide,
yeah.
and that led him to a program which he calls his Adversaries to Allies program. So he says, when I catch the poacher, and he goes out in the field with the police and
yeah.
Actually catches them. When he catches a poacher and the poacher goes to court, and it's clear he's going to be found guilty, Tony says to the judge, let me have a word with the accused. And so he sits him down and he says, I want to make you an offer you can't refuse. He said, if you continue, you're going to be convicted. You'll go to jail for 10 years. When you get out, your wife will have another husband and your children will all be grown up. So you can do that if you wish. Or if you agree, you can plead guilty and I will ask the judge to discharge you into my custody for 5 years. And, of course, he says, nobody ever refuses.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he makes these people into wardens. And he says, of course, they know the whole game. They know exactly how poaching is done. They know who makes money off it. They know who the connections are. And now they become absolutely invaluable allies, he said, and they get to redeem themselves. And at the end, they feel so much better about themselves, quite rightly.
Yeah.
So that's another one of them. And the current one, his current project, is suing the government on the basis that 100% of Filipinos pay for the roads, but only 2% have vehicles.
Mm.
So the 98%, he says, should be entitled to at least 50% of the roads, and he is suing to get that established in law, that 50% of the roads are reserved for non-motorized transportation and other activities, so bicycles, pedestrians, that kind of thing. And his point here is number one, this is just plain equitable. But number two, if you do that, the effect on greenhouse gas emissions from the Philippines will be spectacular. You get mm-hmm. you get rid of a huge, huge load of the greenhouse gas emissions. He'd also like to go to the United Nations and see if the children of the world could ask the United Nations to make a reference to the World Court, asking what is the duty of nations towards their citizens with respect to climate change.
Mm.
Wow, one guy. Yeah. One guy.
Yeah,
one of my great heroes.
Yeah, and you talk to so many people like him who do work that is inspiring. Are governments in other jurisdictions are they say aware of this work and are they perhaps emulating it in wherever they are?
Well, interestingly enough, in a sense, once the government has taken the step of guaranteeing the environmental rights of its citizens, in a sense, the government doesn't really have to do very much more. Now it's up to the citizens. Mm-hmm. So if you and I had that, and let's say we were in Pictou, Nova Scotia, where
yeah.
the pulp mill has been grossly negligent in the emissions that it's mm-hmm. been emitting, we could then go to court and insist and sue the government to enforce its own regulations
right.
or sue the pulp mill to adhere to the regulations. But at the moment, you and I are powerless
mm-hmm.
because we don't have... All we can do in a case like that is press the provincial government to do something, and since the provincial government is generally in bed with the corporations, that's not likely to work very well.
Well, what's to say, though, Don, if whatever is enshrined in law can't be set back by a new regime? I mean, we're sitting here... days after the United States, for example, has elected a new president, someone who quite possibly could turn the clock back on certain green initiatives of previous administrations. Even in the Philippines, there's a new regime there.
Scary guy there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's to say that we get to a place where we have these green rights and they're trampled upon by whoever comes after?
Well, that's not a reason not to put them in the first place, the fact that you may not be able to preserve them indefinitely against all pressures. But the other thing is that, and that's why it's important. This is why Suzuki is insistent that he wants to see this in the Constitution, because you can't change the Constitution with a simple majority vote in the House of Commons. You could change a different kind of law.
Yeah.
And over 100 nations do have it right in their constitutions. And the other thing is, of course, that one mustn't expect that you're going to always be dealing with people who will behaving in the worst possible way.
That's true. Yeah.
Great case in the Netherlands, for example, where the Agenda Foundation has sued the government to do what it said it was going to do at Cancun with respect to climate change, and won. And the government is doing it. I mean, there's a real justice in this. There's a duty of care that governments have towards their citizens. And you really can hold their feet to the fire and say, you've got to do this. This is what you're for.
How many folks are featured in the book?
In the book, I think there's 17 people and 15 interviews, and the reason for the difference in number is that two of them are joint interviews. Mary Margill and Thomas Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Foundation in the States, we interviewed them together, and Pablo Fajardo in Ecuador and Stephen Donziger in the States are both engaged in the big case against Chevron for pollution of the Amazon, known as the Chevron Toxico case.
Yeah.
So we interviewed them, and we put those two interviews into one chapter.
Yeah. Now, are you still doing interviews for the website?
Yeah, the website is called thegreeninterview.com, and we started that in 2009, and basically from very similar motives to your own in starting this interview thing. I was writing a column for the Halifax paper at the time, and I was getting more and more concerned about environmental issues, but I kept also running across more and more people who were doing really interesting things and really important things about that, and I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to sit down with those people and talk about that and to help to promote what they're doing? So that led us to establish a site called thegreeninterview.com, and then it was through thegreeninterview.com that we interviewed David Boyd, and that started the whole Green Rights thing as a sort of a spin-off from that. But yeah, we have nearly 100 interviews there with people like Vandana Shiva and Paul Watson and Jane Goodall and James Lovelock and so on.
Yeah, and they're full-length interviews that people can, they go on the website, they can subscribe there. The first month's free.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can watch. There's a transcript as well if you don't want to watch.
Yep.
And
there's an audio file too.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do things like download the audio file and listen in the car, well, as they do with any other podcast.
Yeah. I mentioned that you have traveled across the country talking about this stuff. When you travel across the country, do you see places? I mean, have you seen places where you know the need for green rights is urgent?
Yes, and there are lots of them. I mean, they generally are things like mines. There's some terrible mining situations or post mining situations across the country. Very often, they're things like pulp mills that are and discharging effluents into the air and the water, and so we've got a lot of issues of that kind in the country. And there's some interesting issues too, in Omgelong First Nation in Sarnia, Ontario. This is a First Nation in the middle of the chemical industry, the petrochemical industry, and they sued the government of Ontario for continuing to issue permits for these polluting industries right next to their property where they already have the worst air in Canada.
Mm.
And they dropped the suit eventually because the government made some accommodations, and there was no point in pursuing it to the Supreme Court and maybe losing when you could take some significant gains as it was now. But there are situations like that across the country where people are beginning to say, well, don't we have, if we have in our Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, doesn't that include the right to breathe? And it may be that one of these cases, there's a couple coming out in New Brunswick as well, and from the Elsie Bucktuck confrontations in 2013, it may be that one of these will get to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will say, yes, the right to life, liberty, and security of the person does include exactly these rights.
So it's not bleak altogether.
No, not at all.
It's quite hopeful. No. And there is reason to hope, because, I mean, with a certain amount of optimism, people do tend to do the right thing, don't they?
They do. They do. Well, and despair is a useless emotion, you know? It takes you nowhere.
Yeah. These interviews that you've done, because we're kindred souls in this, I'm fascinated to know the process. You have a team with you that does this stuff, right? I mean, you conduct the interview, but there are sort of technical people around you. Is that right?
It's not a big team. I'm the guy who generally decides who we're going to interview, and I have a sort of a set of antennae out for that. But I don't have, and other people will make suggestions, you know. But basically, I make that decision, and then I have a wonderful researcher named Linda Panozzo, who herself is an award-winning environmental journalist. And so I basically say to Linda, okay, this is who I want to interview, and this is why I think this interview is important. Make me a briefing document. So she goes out and gets all the information, of the background information, what they've mm-hmm. written, where they've been to school, all that kind of thing. And then I go with my colleague Chris Beckett, who's the videographer, and we do a video interview. But he also extracts from that the audio portion, and we have it transcribed by a transcriber. So ultimately, when it goes up on the site, it's in all three forms, and Chris does all the editing of it as well.
How are you in terms of your timing? And I mean, do you have a set amount of, I mean, most of these people are rather busy, right? So you can't keep them forever. What's that process like for you in terms of extracting what you need and managing your time as well? Because I'm fascinated by process that way.
Yeah, well, in a sense, well, what we've said is that we are going to put up one full-length original interview every month. And I think we may be about to change that. I think and it's partly for logistical reasons. I mean, you come to certain points when you say, well, I don't have an interview. I've got one for this month and next month, but the mm-hmm. one after that, I'm not so sure. And we've been organizing it to a large extent geographically because we just don't have the funds to, and it's irresponsible to be flying around more than you need to be, you know. Mm-hmm. So we would, for example, we went to the Netherlands to talk to the Uganda people, and we did, I think, 5 interviews there in about a week. So we'll kind of, and we arranged all of those at long distance. So we said, well, okay, we're going to be in Utrecht on this day, and we're going to be in The Hague on this day, and so on. Maastricht, and then we flew over and rented a car and just basically went from place to place. Now, another great one was when we went to the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature, and they had a conference in Ecuador, and we were able to do a whole bunch of interviews right there. So that's kind of like the way we try to do it, mm-hmm. and if I get a speaking engagement someplace, then I'll look around and say, well, who have we got there that we'd like to, and then we can bring Chris along and do those interviews at the same time. So it's not. I wish I could say it were. Here's my list of my wish list of interviews, and I'm going to do them 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. Can't do it. Basically, we do it as best we can, and really on a geographical basis, as much as anything.
Now, you mentioned Suzuki, and I'm sure there are other people from this part of the world, from British Columbia, that you talked to, and I'm curious to know who those are.
You
talked to the big guy in Pender.
Pendra Island, and Sabora Berman, Suzuki himself was one of our interviews here. Alexandra Morton from the
she's a tremendous hero for a lot of people, isn't she?
And for me too. Yeah. You know, see, we did another film earlier on called Salmon Wars.
Yeah,
and so we used that opportunity to go and talk to people like her. Daniel Pauly at UBC is a great fisheries scientist who had a great deal to tell us. I think that we have something like 20 interviews from BC, 15, 20, more interviews from BC than from any other single place, I believe.
Yeah, so what does that say about this place? And do you think we're a little more conscious than the rest of the world, maybe? I'd like to think we are.
Of the country, I would certainly say, I think that's true. And I think also BC is, and I also grew up here. I grew up on 23rd Avenue, where the very street that we're now on, 23rd and Dunbar.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well,
on the other side of the city.
Yeah.
But I think, there's a couple of things there. One of them is that the natural landscape out here is so spectacular and so many people are so dedicated to it But also, this has the most polarized political system, I think, in the country. And yeah. You know, basically, it's been growing up here. I mean, I explain to people now that BC politics consists of the NDP and the anti-NDP. And the anti-NDP may be called social credit or conservative or coalition, all of which I've seen in my life, or liberal as it is now.
Yeah.
But it's basically there's the NDP and the guys who don't want the NDP in power, and and I think that's part of there's a history here of people, you know, being very open about their conflicts and you know, being very very upfront about their values and very passionate about them and willing to go into the streets and you know, fight for them. So I think that's less common in the rest of the country, and it's certainly not common in the Maritimes.
Yeah. You know, I was looking at a map the other day, and because I haven't really traveled much of British Columbia, even having lived here my whole life. I just realize how big the place is and how diverse it is just geographically, you know, and the kinds of, you know, the places where you can go. And I guess in a way that's what makes this place so special, and how we need to really think about these green issues, because, you know, a lot of this stuff could disappear in a very short period of time.
And has disappeared. Yeah. It does disappear. When I was growing up, I was told that the forests of British Columbia were essentially inexhaustible, that you no matter how hard you went at cutting them, they would grow back as fast as you could possibly cut them. Well, I'm, you know, in my 70s now, so this is, what, 50, 60 years ago. And, you know, in recent years, I fly over British Columbia, and I see whole mountains clear-cut. I mean, I see mountains shaved. And, you know, the people come to the Maritimes in Nova Scotia, or British Columbians come to the Maritimes, and they say, my God, the trees are so small. Well, guess what? They didn't used to be. When people came to the Maritimes, they came and they were taking huge timbers from masts for the king's ships and things like that. And now we can't get a boom or a mast for the Bluenose out of the timbers that we now have. Well, that's the future of British Columbia, too. These trees are only here for as long as they're kept here. There are industrial interests out there who would do what they did in the Philippines, right? Yeah. Take every last stick. Yeah.
You're doing important work, and it's inspiring work. And needless to say, urgent work. And so congratulations on all that, and continued good luck with your efforts, because a lot of us need to know this stuff. And thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. It's also fun, I should just add. I mean, it sounds terribly, terribly earnest, and of course it is, but meeting these people is just a joy.
Yeah.
You know, just
I'll bet.
Pleasure.
Yeah. SilverDonaldCameron.ca is the website, and of course, thegreeninterview.com. That's where you can purchase the film and the book. Silver Donald Cameron, joining me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunter.